1CA is a product of the Civil Affairs Association and brings in people who are current or former military, diplomats, development officers, and field agents to discuss their experiences on ground with the partner nation's people and leadership. Our goal is to inspire anyone interested in working the last 3 feet of foreign relations. To contact the show, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com or look us up on the Civil Affairs Association website at www.civilaffairsassoc.org. I'll have those in the show notes.
Welcome to One Civil Affairs Podcast. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Brian Hancock, and I will be your host for this session. Today, we're going to explore the concepts of military campaigning, civil harm mitigation, and how to align just war with postmodern conflict. To get after this, I have with me Major J. David Thompson. He's a civil affairs major assigned to the U.S. Africa Command. He holds a Juris Doctorate from Washington and Lee University School of Law. He is a PhD candidate at King's College London, where he is researching the ethics of proxy warfare. Major Thompson, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, sir.
All right, before we begin, Dave, our quick disclaimer, a reminder to our audience that all remarks made are those of the presenters solely. All right, let's begin. Dave, can you tell me a little bit about your current positions and duties of what you're doing there at US AFRICOM?
Thank you. So I am a civil military operations planner at US AFRICOM. That sits within the J5. Within our division, we have also the humanitarian assistance portfolio, largely think the ODACA programs. We have a number of interagency representatives from Conflict Stabilization Office, Department of State, Foreign Policy Advisor from State Department, a Public Health Advisor from DHEP. We also have a liaison from Pacific Disaster Center, or PDC Global, and the PDC Global liaison works with our climate branch.
That's a lot.
Yes, that is a lot, but luckily we have really good leadership and a good crew in our division.
Fantastic. I was worried you're never going to get to sleep with all those duties on your plate. All right, let's jump into our first varsity level question. You recently wrote an award-winning civil affairs issue paper. Let me read the exact title. Campaigning the Campaign Plan, Focusing on the Fundamentals at the Combatant Command by Assessing Civil Affairs Operations, Activities, and Investments, the famous OANIs there. Now, it feels to me that the Army's come full circle. When I started my career 18 years ago, military campaigns were a thing. They were discussed. And then suddenly the term fell out of vogue. I never understood quite why. But now it's back. So campaigns are back on the menu, huh?
I appreciate the historical perspective. So I came in the Army in 2008, and I can't say whether campaigns went away, at least doctrinally. But when I was a young lieutenant in Afghanistan, part of the global war on terror, I had the opportunity to meet General Stan Crystal at the time. He was talking to me, he was doing his battlefield circulation as the commander, and I was telling him all the things we were doing to help the Afghan security forces. And he interrupts me, he's like, what would you do if you had to stay here until the war broke? And it made me think that, well, I would probably spend a little bit more of my time focused on building a partner force so that way I could hand this off to somebody, because as I was doing it, and ideally it needs to be somebody else doing it for us to win. So that started me thinking of how my rotation fit into numerous rotations. So then we changed our approach, and during that time, you know, maybe to use a sports analogy, the ball was on the 20-yard line and I was going to try to get it to the 30-yard line. And that would mean our partners doing more and us doing less. That's still within that advise and assist role.
That makes sense to me. And I love your analogy on incremental movements, right? When we're talking about all these very complicated systems and politics and economics, where strategic objectives tend to lie, these are not things that are solved quickly, especially in areas where you've got deep sectarian violence, hatred, and other things. And, you know, and at the end of the day, I think not only as civil affairs officers, but as military officers in general, you know, we need to keep moving that needle to the right. Love that anecdote that you mentioned with General McChrystal, too. One of the generals in, you know, the famous book, The Four Star, very interesting individual. for the audience, I think that their experience with the word campaign is in a political sense rather than in a military sense. For clarification, how does the Department of Defense define that term? And if you don't mind, can you just explain how it's different from an operation, an engagement, or a theater plan, which are other terms we hear bantered about a bunch?
So they're just campaigning as the verb, which is in Joint Publication 3.0. And I'm going to read a bit of the definition here. So the Department of Defense defines campaign in part as the persistent conduct of related operations, activities, and investments that align military actions with other instruments of national power in pursuit of campaign objectives. Now, that differs from campaign plan and campaign, which come from Joint Publication 5.0. So a campaign is a series of related operations within a given time and space, and a campaign plan is a joint operation plan for a series of related major operations within time and space. So ideally, you have the campaign plan, which lists out the campaign objectives, the intermediate military objectives, and then the effects subordinate to those IMOs or intermediate military objectives. Then you have the campaign order, which provides tasks to components. Those tasks generate operations, activities, and investments, or OAIs. So components can then have OAIs linked to tasks, and the combatant command can have tasks linked to effects, linked to IMOs, and linked to campaign objectives. So if you think about it linearly, you should be able to draw a line between an operation, activity, or investment, an OAI, directly to a campaign objective.
I know NATO talks a little bit about end states as opposed to objectives, just a different way of looking at it, or desired conditions as you're moving towards things in a plan. It seems that based upon how DoD looks at a campaign, it's kind of on that cusp between operations and strategy with an ability to be broken down to tactical tasks and activities that support it. Let's go deeper into strategy and operations. In the paper that you published, you mentioned that the connection between strategy and operations is inherent. I know you've read Sean McPhake's work, you're pretty well read. In that, he and other military scholars argue that America has actually lost every war since World War II, as measured by a failure to complete the strategic objectives of those conflicts. Now, given the potential connection between strategy and operations, what do you think went wrong? As a force, do we just suck at operations and that in turn causes our strategy to fail in many of these wars? What do you think?
So first, one of the unique things about that paper was it didn't call for any new .milPFP solutions. It just uses current doctrine and what we have available. So anybody can go through and use it. Now the paper is published with the Civil Affairs Association, is publicly available. Another aspect on looking at this, I talked about OAIs and the campaign objectives. I forgot to mention maybe the measuring and assessments of those tasks, which are important and maybe lead to your point. You should be able to measure both quantitatively and qualitatively through measures of effects and measures of performance if the OAIs, or what people are being tasked to do, are helping to reach the campaign objectives. If not, why not? Do there need to be new structures, new processes, more guidance, additional resources or authorities? So that's where the role of assessments comes into play. So you mentioned Sean McPhake. So he wrote a book, The New Rules of War, about the same time that Richard Haass wrote A World in Disarray. And they both looked at the same question broadly and approached it in two very different ways. And their solutions to solving it were greater. I think if you read those two books side by side, you can draw your own conclusions.
Thanks for that. Obviously, these are hot political issues as well as military issues. To use an egregious example, if we take a look at the war in Iraq, don't know if you read Mark Perry's book, The Pentagon Wars, but he makes a pretty cogent case that the Iraq War actually reduced security abroad, caused some chaos, empowered Iran, Russia, and ISIS, damaged relationships between the civil and the military, nearly bankrupt the nation, and of course got many, many Americans as well as Iraqis killed. And relative to the strategic objectives, it doesn't look like that is a victory. So going back to what you said about assessments, did we just pick the wrong things to do? And then therefore the rosy assessments, which you know I saw, were just measuring the wrong things?
The point here is how do we define victory? And maybe this is larger to John's question, but we're talking there. I'll use this as an opportunity to introduce some of the concepts under the just war tradition. One of the key jus ad bellum criteria is the chance of success, but it doesn't define what success is. So Douglas MacArthur stated in his Farewell to Congress, in war, there can be no substitute for victory. But what is victory? If you want to think competition or regular warfare, where does that distinction lie? I think it's easy to think about winning conventional wars. You know, it's easy to see one side's going to win, going to lose, go home, promise not to do it again, make some reparations. But in a competition, what is victory? Or in a regular warfare, what is victory? I think it's also interesting to think about the word competition. Are you using competition descriptively or prescriptively? If you're using competition to merely describe the activities that you're doing, that's no strategy. If you're using competition to prescribe activities, say the global competition XOR, then you can start to think about applying these criteria and start to see what success may be. There's another great book, since we're talking about a lot of books here, Ali Wine, America's Great Power Opportunity. He looks at competition more descriptively, but looking at opportunities through this.
That's great. I think we could probably have an entire podcast on just talking about the different definitions of victory and competition. I think those are hot terms. And I suspect, depending on who you ask, you're probably going to get very different definitions. When we look back at some of these wars, I think if you were to ask the Joint Chiefs of Staff if they were victorious, I think in many of them they'd probably say they were. Then when we look from maybe a political lens or a socioeconomic lens, perhaps not. So I think that's one of the challenges, and you talk about it in some of your other papers, with the graying of modern warfare, our definitions just kind of haven't kept pace. Let's move on to the next question. You spent some time addressing assessments in your publication and referred to it earlier. Now, these are critical, and particularly as we move up echelon, they often direct resourcing. Now, in my experience, assessing non-lethal effects are challenging. Many of the things we're trying to affect are complex adaptive human systems, which have a relation to operations, activities, and investment. Now, to use an example of a difficult non-lethal assessment, one of the taskings we often get at U.S. Army, Europe, and Africa is for a civil affairs action team or a four-man CAT team to assess a tactical ODACA project. You talked about ODACA there earlier in your office. And typically, that team has not been part of that project before and may not have context or baselines. And it is asked to assess how that typically tactical level project has advanced U.S. and NATO strategic objectives. And unfortunately, the team is usually only given a few days to accomplish this. Now, given the math and science required to conduct a statistically valid assessment, how do you think we can do this better? Can we do this better?
So, we also use what we call country program monitoring for projects. I believe it is required by law. Now, we schedule ours out a bit, so perhaps I could put our CPM manager in touch and they can share some best practices. But I think one of the other things about this is looking when civil affairs forces are giving these very complicated tasks to do. I think that's one of the great things about being a civil affairs officer or soldier. We get tasked to do hard things. We don't solve easy problems. So we recruit and train smart people and we put them through teams with other talented, smart people. And then we give them complex, challenging problems to solve. So it's fascinating. And generally, they come out successful. Like, we'd be hard-pressed to think of a time when I've seen a team take on a challenging problem and not come away with some ideas that were very creative and help solve it and bring about success. So that's one of the great things about being a Civil War soldier. If that appeals to anybody who's listening, who's not a Civil War soldier, definitely get in contact with Colonel Hancock himself. Anybody in the Civil Affairs Association, I'm sure, is willing to help you. To the first part of the question about the assessments piece, right? So at the geographic combatant command level, I think about assessments maybe a little bit different than like a tactical unit assessment. So we want to know for assessments, are the things we're doing helping us reach our campaign objectives? So great, let's keep going. If not, again, what do we need? Do we need a new structure, process, guidance, resources? What is it that we need to do to help them achieve these campaign objectives? As far as the individual assessments of an Avaka project, those are great, but at the command level, what I'm more interested in are those assessments helping somebody else make a decision. I'm not so concerned about that decision, just that we have forces available working towards doing that, and that they're informing people who are making decisions, the process of what we call civil knowledge integration.
I actually like your characterization of that, right? All models are wrong, but if it's useful, then it's worth investing in. You know, what I hear you saying there is, okay, maybe the precise analytical value and relation of a project to strategic impact is hard to measure. But if it moves the ball forward, if it teaches us something we didn't know, if it builds a valuable relationship we didn't have, then that is still useful in and of itself. All we're required to do as a government is conduct legal acceptance, which is more of an MOP, right? Let's say the project was to build a fuel pumping station, just making this up. Does it pump fuel? Does it hold fuel? Is it safe? Okay, yeah. And is the price what we agreed? Then we accept that. But in terms of the value of that towards the campaign, the operational objective, that value could be shown in many different ways. And that's why we do both qualitative and quantitative assessments, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay, so let's keep talking about assessments. That's a real hot topic. You've worked at AFRICOM for a while, and one of the things that AFRICOM did is they held a civil affairs summit, which you participated in. And one of the things that caught my eye in your write-up regarding the summit was the extensive indicators that all the participants developed to attempt to capture CA impacts and garner useful measurements. Examples of these are number of episodic engagements, numbers of partners requesting civil military operations, embassies requesting civil affairs forces, and a number of others. Now, mathematically, these are obviously somewhat different concepts. How did these desperate factors get normalized, scored, and weighted to determine an accurate assessment framework?
That's really good. So we have a quality assessment team at AFRICOM. And that's also, anybody looking to replicate, I would point you to Annex K of JP5-0. In the paper, I basically just talked about our implementation of doctrine. Now, the actual indicators we developed are linked to our campaign objectives. So the campaign objectives are classified, so in the paper, I used what was likely to be relevant to the civil affairs audience. So what you're going to see as far as the indicators aren't exactly what we created during the summit is analogous, so using kind of tailored towards a civil affairs audience. But I think what more people are going to care about is less about the actual indicators AFRICOM developed, and more of the process that we use. So that's where I would prefer, I think, listeners to focus. So what links the tasks and the OAIs with the desired outcomes? Now, there were some pitfalls to avoid. Assessments don't inherently come with funding, and it creates work for downtrace teams. So we can have a perfect assessments framework, but we have to balance that with all the labor that goes into that with the operations piece. And then the assessments need to be for, like, are we assessing things just for the sake of assessing them? Or are they helping people make decisions moving forward? What are they helping to answer? Civil affairs doesn't exist in a vacuum. So what are the strategic assessments helping to provide a comprehensive understanding to commanders?
I think the assessments problem in non-lethal effects is one of those complicated things that probably drew you and I to civil affairs. And obviously, as you go up echelon, where you have more resources, one of the ways that we add value to our subordinate units is to help them with those assessments, right? Because we may have more ORSAs, more collection capabilities, more other things to do that. I don't think you and I are going to solve the assessment issues today, but I'm glad that we continue having that discussion. Let's keep going with Africa here. The National Defense Strategy in 2022 identifies China as the U.S. pacing threat and Russia as an acute threat. Through the One Belt, One Road initiative, China is conducting significant engagement in Africa, as are the Russians, through their private military companies like the Wagner Group and their recent media purchases. For additional context, in his book Factfulness, Dr. Hans Rossinger defines what he calls the pin code of the world. It's a very interesting idea. And that's how the 7 billion people on the planet are distributed. Now, at present, only 1 billion reside in Africa, while 4 billion reside in Asia. I suspect that's why PACOM has a lot of funding right now. Now, fast forward, though, to the year 2100, Dr. Rossinger points out that if demographic trends continue, Asia will only have grown to 5 billion inhabitants. But Africa will have quadrupled its population to 4 billion. And given all this and other things you're aware of, it just seems to me that the U.S. military, particularly civil affairs, should be far more active in Africa. This is episode 1 of 2. The second half will air next week.
Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, please like and subscribe and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. Also, if you're interested in coming on the show or hosting an episode, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com. I'll have the email and CA Association website in the show notes. And now, most importantly, to those currently out in the field, working with a partner nation's people or leadership to forward U.S. relations, thank you all for what you're doing. This is Jack, your host. Stay tuned for more great episodes, One CA Podcast.